Today we're going to look at the first chapter of Malachi. And we're going to look at some people who were almost right, at least kind of right. They were on the right track, but what they were doing really wasn't right. And what was happening was the result was improper or false worship. These people knew exactly what they were doing wrong, and they knew that it was not right. Well, through Malachi, God is rebuking the Israelite priests and the people of Israel for their worship practices. And in doing so, God reveals to us what true worship should be, what he expects from us as his followers. The Israelites were not involved in true worship because they were not bringing true sacrifices. And we need to learn from this that true worship requires true sacrifice. The book of Malachi is a book of prophecy to the children of Israel, to the nation of Israel, and most scholars agree that it was written after the return of the exiles from Babylon. It must have been written after the time that the temple was rebuilt in 515 BC because the sacrificial system is in full swing, and apparently it's been going on for a while because of the way that the people are treating their sacrifices. But other than that, we really don't have a lot to date the book. Okay, there's a couple of words in it that came from Assyria and so on and so forth. So we've got kind of an idea. And it had to be before the fall of the kingdom of Edom because the book talks about Edom. And that fell sometime around 312 BC. Okay, so now I know that's a lot of dates, okay, and a lot of numbers. And I certainly don't want to lose anybody this early in the sermon with a history lesson. But I think it's significant that we cannot date the book accurately. I wanted to point out that I don't think it's a coincidence that we can't date it. You see, the book of Malachi deals with improper worship. And this is an issue that's timeless. From Genesis 4, with Cain and Abel, until the last days, when 2 Timothy 3:5 says that the men are going to have a form of godliness but deny its power, improper worship has been a problem from the beginning. It's still a problem now, and it will continue to be a problem. And so the warnings of Malachi are applicable. God has adopted Israel as his own. Starting with Abraham, through Isaac and Jacob, God has declared that Israel is his chosen people. We see this throughout the Old Testament. There should have been no doubt in the minds of the people what their relationship was with God. He's their God, and they are his people. I mean, who else did he rescue with a mighty hand, rolling back oceans, bringing forth food and water in the desert in order to satisfy their thirst and to fill their stomachs for millions of people? Who else did he call his firstborn son? As God displayed his hand to Israel, bringing him out of Egypt, their immediate response was gratitude. They praised the Lord as they're leaving Egypt. Later, as God's preparing to lead them into the promised land, Moses instructs Israel to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and to be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. They were to have an attitude of thankfulness because true worship requires gratitude. God points out Israel's failure. They don't honor him. They don't honor him even as one would honor an earthly father or a loving master. Verse 6 reminds us that in order to approach God, it requires that we relate to him in two different ways. And these two ways, there's a built-in tension between them. The first way that we're to approach God is as a loving father. Now, how do we try to treat our fathers? We treat them with respect. We honor them. We love them. We desire to please them. Just watch any child with his father when they interact. They want to make their father proud. I should point out now that next week is Father's Day. They want to make their father proud. There's a desire to do the things that will please their father. There's a desire, at least until they're teenagers, to obey their father. There's a personal, even an intimate relationship between a father and his child. The father delights in his child, and the child delights in delighting his father. But we must also approach God as our master. There should be a sense of awe, even a sense of healthy fear as we come to him. He is the sovereign Lord of all creation. You know, sometimes I feel like we've lost that, or at least we ignore it in our society today. And we tend to think of God as a sibling sitting in the back seat saying, "You're not the boss of me. He's breathing on me." Instead of as a father who's sitting in the front seat saying, "I'm going to pull this car over." Yeah, he knows us better than we know ourselves. Yes, as Hebrews 4:16 says, we can approach the throne with boldness, but we must never lose that sense of awe that we're standing before the throne of the holy God. I think of Esther. You know, she's approaching her husband, who is the king, and she's in fear because he has the power of life and death over her. She's confident as she approaches him of their relationship, but still there's a fear because he is the ruler and he can have her put to death just for approaching him. So she approaches him with confidence, and she also approaches him with fear of his awesome power. Or maybe Isaiah, as he sees the vision of the Lord high and lifted up, sitting on his throne, what's his response? "Woe to me, I am undone. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I have seen God Almighty." One more, Thomas, with Jesus after his resurrection, locked in that room. A man who had been in contact with Jesus for 3 years, almost daily talking to Jesus, interacting with him. If anybody knew him intimately, it was the apostles. But as he looks at the nail-scarred hands and the spear scars inside, what is his response? "My Lord and my God." Is that our response? God had chosen Israel, and he expected a response of love, and he expected a response of honor. So worship is a response of love and honor. So as we approach God in worship, we should approach him both as a loving father and a loving master. But the priests were approaching him neither as father nor master. Instead, they were treating him with contempt. They were treating the holy things of God as everyday, unimportant things. God's charge here is directed at the priests. As a matter of fact, most of the first 1.5 chapters of Malachi are addressed specifically to the priests. In the Old Testament, the priests were responsible for administering the worship of the Israelites. As descendants of Abraham, they had been chosen by God to act as intermediaries between the people and God. And one of their duties was to ensure that the sacrifices being presented to God were acceptable. They were responsible to God for the worship of the people. So, all right, we're off the hook, right? We don't have to worry about that. We're not priests. That's great. But remember that the priests were only sacrificing what the people were bringing them to sacrifice. And while God finds fault with the priests for not upholding their position, it's also a problem with the people. And besides, 1 Peter 2:9 says that as Christians, we are a royal priesthood. That is, we can approach God directly. We don't need an earthly priest between us. But that also means that we're totally responsible for what we bring to God, what we bring before him as an offering. We don't have somebody else to look at it and say, "Yes, that's acceptable," or "That's not." In our passage, the sacrifices that were being brought did not honor God. The Israelites were bringing blind and crippled and diseased animals as offerings to him. Now, this is not a small matter. Look at the structure of the charge in verse 8. It could easily have been worded, "When you bring blind, crippled, or diseased animals, is that not wrong?" Or as the New American Standard puts it, "Is that not evil?" But that's not the way it's in there. There's a definite emphasis here. It says, when you bring blind animals, it's evil. When you bring crippled or diseased animals, it's evil. God is emphasizing that if you're not bringing the right thing, that it's evil. So why would this be such a big deal? First, there's an issue of obedience. This issue is pretty straightforward, right? According to the sacrificial law, the Israelites were expected to bring God the first and the best. By not doing so, they were showing contempt for God's law. And second, there's an issue of respect. God tells them that their sacrifices were not even appropriate for another person, for an earthly master, much less for God. When we have someone that we consider to be important coming over for dinner, what do we do? You pull out the china, right? You pull out the silver. When was the last time you pulled out the silver or you pulled out the china when you're just having a couple of friends over to watch a football game? Okay? It doesn't happen. But when you have somebody important coming over, let's say the president. President's coming over. Okay, I don't care about your politics. If the president's coming over, that's a big deal. Maybe the governor. How about some king from some foreign country? He's coming over, he's going to come for dinner. Are you going to go out and get the cheapest thing possible? I mean, are you going to buy fruit that's half rotten? Are you going to buy meat that could be diseased? Well, of course not. You're not going to do that. And why not? Because you want them to know that you honor them, that you respect them. If not them, at least their position. You'd present them with the best that you could find. But that's not what the Israelites were doing. God points out that they would never present to their leaders what they were presenting to him. The sacrifices weren't even an appropriate gift for an earthly master, much less God. They were not honoring God with their worship. So our lesson from this is that worship must honor the recipient. But the Israelites weren't doing that. They were more concerned about their standing with a government official than they would be with their standing with God. They were more worried about honoring a man than they were honoring God. What they were giving to God was not even good enough to give to another person. But you know, they still wanted God to accept them. In spite of their contempt for the things of God, the Israelites were still seeking the grace of God. As they presented him with less than their best, they expected God to return his best. God points out to them the inconsistency in their thinking. He says, with such offerings from his hand, from your hands, will he accept you or will he receive you kindly? When you went before a ruler to request a favor, it was customary to bring a gift. And God is telling them, with the gifts that you're trying to bring me, why should I even let you in to hear your case? Furthermore, God had already provided for them. He was the one who provided their flocks. He was the one who had provided their land. He was the one who had provided for their very existence. And so, the offerings that they were bringing were not appropriate for the grace that they had already received. Worship must be appropriate. The appropriate offerings would have been to bring their best as an offering of thanksgiving for what God had already provided for them. Israel was not performing true worship because they failed to exhibit the gratitude that would be appropriate given the unique relationship that they had with God. But gratitude's not enough for true worship. Sometimes true worship is difficult. And in those times, true worship requires fortitude. Let me paraphrase verse 10, at least the first part of it. God says, I wish one of you would have the guts to shut the temple down. What you're doing is worthless. Just shut it down. Don't be involved in false worship anymore. You're not helping anyone. As a matter of fact, you're hurting them. They think because you say everything's okay that it is. You're leading the people astray. Have the guts to refuse to be involved in this false worship. Don't condone it. That would be an act of true worship. Imagine the fallout of that. Then imagine the revival that would take place. What would happen today if we did the same kind of thing? If we refused to be involved in any sort of false worship? How would our churches change? How would our lives change? But for some reason, we think that this can't happen today. These kind of things just don't happen. But if they do, or if they do, we can spot it and we can take care of it. You know, those things only happen in those kinds of churches. You know, we sang a song earlier. It was called The Heart of Worship. And I asked Richard to put that in the service this week because that song grew out of a situation very much like the one that we're talking about here. Matt Redman, the man who wrote the song, he's a very popular Christian songwriter and recording artist, but he's also a music minister in England. And as you can imagine, people started coming to the church he was at because Matt Redman was there. And the music was really, really good. But as time went on, it became more and more about how the band was. How did the band play? How did the band sound this week? And less about God. The band itself, Matt Redman, they all got caught up in it. I mean, they're people. They're human, just like everybody else is. And then the pastor did something that took a lot of guts. He got rid of the band. at least for a while. He got rid of the soundboard. He got rid of the instruments. As Redmond says, the pastor's point was that we'd lost our way in worship. The pastor reminded the congregation that they were to be producers of worship, not just consumers. The pastor asked the congregation, he says, when you come through the doors on Sunday morning, what offering are you bringing to God? Eventually, they did start adding the instruments back, and they got the whole band back, but when they came back, it was with a totally different attitude. I'll bring you more than a song, because a song in itself is not what you have required. Sometimes it's really difficult not to be swept along with the crowd, but God's instruction here is very clear. Shut the doors on false worship. Instead, invite pure worship. Because the kicker is that if our worship is not pure, God will reject it. To be acceptable to God, worship must be pure. So what does that mean? God had defined for the Israelites what worship was to be. As part of that worship, he told the Israelites what type of offerings were acceptable to him. But the offerings themselves, just like Matt Redman's songs, were not the most important piece. 1 Samuel 15:22 says, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams." God was more interested in obedience. He was more interested in people's hearts. At this point, the Israelites had chosen to ignore the requirements that God had given them. But in spite of Israel's disobedience, in verse 11, God says that his name will be great among the nations all throughout the world. He doesn't say that it would be nice if worship occurred. He doesn't say that worship might occur. He says that worship will occur. And in contrast to the false worship of the Israelites, it will be pure worship. Jesus addressed the same issue with the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 when she asked him if worship must be in Jerusalem or on Mount Gerizim. Jesus told her that the physical location of the worship is not what's important. Instead, he told her that true worship is the result of worshiping in spirit and in truth. God will be worshiped. And he will be worshiped in every place. And we see this now as the word of God goes out throughout the whole world. He's not yet worshiped by every tongue, nation, and tribe, but the time is coming, and it's coming very quickly when he will be. So even though we may have the gratitude necessary for true worship, and even the fortitude to avoid being drawn into false worship, that's not enough. True worship requires a proper attitude. Instead of making the name of God great, the priests were profaning it. Under the Jewish sacrificial system, the priests received the sacrifices from the altar for their food. That's what they ate. But they were destroying the reputation of the Lord by complaining about the food that was being provided to them. The priests were slandering the name of the Lord by saying that the Lord's altar was being defiled. And here's the real irony of it. The priests were the ones defiling it. And it was quite a burden, I'm sure. They were very tired. It was a burden doing all of these sacrifices. You know, it seems like the priests were just tired of doing the things that a priest should be doing. And can't you just see them as they sit there and sniff contemptuously, you know, at the food that they had? It's just not good enough for them. It's good enough for God, but it's not good enough for me. They're haughty. They're prideful. But true worship is humble. The priests, instead of being humble, have put themselves above God. We may say that at least we don't have to worry about that today. That's not a problem that we have, but let me put it in today's perspective. How many people do you know who will donate something to the church that they will not put in their house? It may be almost completely worn out, or it may be completely worn out, but you know they sure could use it up at the church. You see, we're not so different, are we? What does that tell us about our hearts? And while I'm at it, let me meddle a little bit more. What's it like around your house on Sunday morning? Are you looking forward to a time of Bible study? Are you even involved in one of our Bible studies? Or is it a burden to have to get up every week and get dressed and get ready and get out the door and get to church on time? And boy, I sure hope the service doesn't run long today. Where are you being fed? How contemptible is your food? I'm going to repeat the earlier question of the pastor from England. What have you brought as an offering to the Lord today? Once again, God rebukes the priest for allowing for the sacrifice of injured or maimed or diseased animals. But then God goes on and he puts a responsibility back on the people themselves. The person who vows an animal to the Lord is to bring the best. All of the animals that were offered for sacrifice were supposed to be without defect. In Leviticus, God sets out the requirements and the procedures for all of the offerings that were to be presented to him. And in order for the offering to be acceptable, the animal presented must have been without defect. But apparently, there was a problem going on. People were making vows, and then instead of bringing an unblemished animal, a suitable offering, they would bring a substandard animal. The New American Standard translates it as you bring what is taken by robbery and what is lame or sick. So maybe they'd even go steal an animal to bring as a sacrifice to God. You know, when your whole livelihood depends on your herds, how difficult would it be to bring your prize bull to be slaughtered as a sacrifice to God? And so the people would try to cheat God, to steal from him, if you want to get right down to it. But true worship is honest. Did they think that they were fooling God? God said, the one who reneges on his vow is cursed. The one who substitutes something less valuable is denied the blessings that would normally be expected from a relationship with God. You know, the Levitical laws were very plain. The offerings brought to God were to be the best that could be had. The finest wine, the best grain, the most perfect animals. The offerings made to God were not to be taken lightly. They were not to be mundane, the commonplace, the everyday things. God desires our best, and that means that true worship is costly. At the end of 2 Samuel, David went to offer a burnt offering to the Lord. And Arunna offered to give David everything that was necessary. But David told him he would not offer burnt offerings to the Lord that cost him nothing. If it cost him nothing, there would be no sacrifice. His worship was costly. Moses' original instructions to the Israelites were repeated by Jesus when he said that the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. That is, we are to love the Lord our God with every fiber of our being. True worship is costly. In Romans 12, Paul urges us to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is our spiritual act of worship. Offer ourselves as living sacrifices. True worship is costly. And so now I have a question for you. What sort of sacrifice do you offer the Lord? If you're not a Christian, there's only one answer to that question. Anything that you would bring to offer God would be inadequate. Any sacrifice that you bring is going to be blemished. It's going to be blemished by the stain of sin. But Jesus Christ died to take away that blemish. The only begotten of Son died so that you would no longer live under the curse as someone who would bring a blemished offering to the Lord. He offers you that gift now. There's a time to accept this gift of grace, and that time is now. Will you accept it? Will you, for the first time, be able to offer God a true sacrifice? If you are a Christian, are you giving God your best? Are you giving Him your best in your day-to-day life? Or are you giving Him second best? Think about the time that you spend with non-Christians. What do they see? Are they seeing a life that's devoted to God? Or is it a life that gives God what's left over? Do you present to the world a life that's shamelessly blemished, that's blind to the things of God, that's crippled by a walk that consistently goes off the path of righteousness? Do you then try to present that life as an acceptable offering to God? Will we continue to give God our second best? Or will we help the whole world from the rising to the setting of the sun to declare the mighty name of God?